Sometimes you just want to wallow in Doctor Who feels.
And sometimes you want to interrogate the text, apply the methodology, and explore the liminal spaces between the author and audience.
In our Fandom Perspective series, we're talking about academic fandom.
Because you can study the thing you love.
On the June 19th edition of This Week in Time Travel. We are here to talk about academic fandom on this week's edition of the Fandom Perspective series. So we're looking forward to having Kara Dennison and Derek Compare with us. And that'll be after our news segment. And so there was some big exciting news that dropped last week announcing that Jodie Whittaker and Chris Chibnall would be at San Diego Comic-Con between July 19th and 22nd. Scheduled to be determined later, along with Tosin Cole, Mandeep Gill, executive producer Matt Stevens. This, I think, could be the first proper, honest-to-goodness sneak peek of Series 11, and I just feel a little bad for our friends in the UK. You know, Doctor Who's a British show, and all of the spectacular kickoff stuff always seems to happen at an American Comic Con.
Well, you know what? Don't feel too bad, because Paul Cornell is going to be at Comic-Con, and guess who's not going to be at Comic-Con? This American. I'm a little bitter over here because he's going to have fun, and I'm not.
This American is not going to be there either. That's going to be an exciting panel, loads of enthusiasm, Jodie Whittaker's Comic-Con debut. There's nothing that could possibly have sullied this fantastic moment or that could have taken away attention from all of the good press that Doctor Who will presumably be getting. And yet,
this conversation will be kept fairly short in terms of the actual controversy, and trigger warnings do apply. We won't be getting into the details, but unfortunately, over this past weekend, a ex-girlfriend of presenter Chris Hardwick, who has moderated panels for Doctor Who at San Diego Comic-Con for some time now, revealed that he severely abused her during the course of their relationship. And it took a little over 24 hours for the individuals involved with booking Chris Hardwick to announce that he would no longer be presenting during the panel, which I'm incredibly grateful for, because the last thing that we needed at this moment was for Chris Hardwick to be the face of one of the most exciting moments in Doctor Who's history. More importantly, however, he should not be able to build his platform on the back of this moment. This cannot be his redemption tour. This cannot be his apology tour. This can't be his anything. He's canceled. We're not going to be promoting him anymore, because abusers should not get platforms in order to continue making a name for themselves. One brief thing that I did want to discuss about this, because I think it's important to have this conversation, is that the statement that was released was interesting in two respects. One is that AMC Networks, which owns BBC America, which brings Doctor Who to Comic-Con every year, said that Chris Hardwick had decided not to host the panel. It's a little bit of an interesting thing to say, as if this was something that was just him doing something out of the goodness of his heart, and not that his presence there would have been massively disruptive and horrifying and potentially triggering for many of the individuals in the audience. The second is that they opened up this statement by saying that we have had a positive working relationship with Chris Hardwick for many years, which is a very, very questionable thing for you to post when this man has been accused of some fairly extreme abuse towards his ex-girlfriend. I don't know exactly what they intended to say when they included that line. It's quite possible they wanted to say, holy crud, we did not know this. We never saw anything similar to this in our working relationship with him. But unfortunately, the way that comes across to many people is he is a good guy and we are refusing to have him host our panel simply because these allegations are a distraction. And, you know, that's not a thing that you should do. You really should just cut to the chase and go, we're investigating, and in the meantime, we won't be giving him a platform. You don't need to say anything about how you think that he was a good or decent person when you were working with him. We believe the women. We believe Chloe Dykstra. And you can just say, no, canceled, next. That's it.
And the less said about Chris Hardwick from now until the end of time, the better.
He's canceled. He's done.
On a much brighter note, the new Target novels that we've been saying so much about in the last several weeks are finally on sale in the U.S. today as this episode is released. And Alyssa, you've reviewed them.
Well, I've reviewed some of them. So I was very impatient to get my hands on these books. And my ever supportive mother, who basically at this point says, give me an Amazon link because I won't know how to find it otherwise, went and got three of the novels from me from Amazon UK. It took forever for them to get shipped here, but I did receive Rose, which was adapted by writer Russell T. Davies. I got The Christmas Invasion, which was adapted by Jenny Colgan. And I also got Twice Upon a Time, which was adapted by Paul Cornell. They're amazing. They're incredible books. You can go to my blog, whovianfeminism.tumblr.com. It will be the most recent post. So you can read my review there. And basically, if you've never seen those stories before, which is unlikely given this podcast audience, but if you've never seen them before, they are excellent standalone books. If you are just trying to give a book and hoping to trick somebody into liking Doctor Who, those are good books to do it for. If you've rewatched those stories many, 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 many times, you will be very pleasantly surprised because they are new, they are different, and it is an entirely new and wonderful experience to read those stories again. So I would highly recommend them, and I look forward to getting the other two books, The Day of the Doctor by Stephen Moffat and City of Death by James Goss, when they come out in the United States. And we also have some additional, hopefully good news. Doctor Who has been submitted to the Emmy ballots as of June 11th. It is competing for Best TV Movie, which is how Sherlock got those Emmy noms. Twice Upon a Time has been submitted for the Emmy voters' consideration. So if you happen to be one of those people, hey, consider Twice Upon a Time.
Rachel Talalay is up for Best Director, Stephen Moffat for Best Writer, Peter Capaldi for Best Actor, Pearl Mackey for Best Actress, and Twice Upon a Time for Best TV Movie. I kind of wish that they submitted the whole series, but maybe they just saw the writing on the wall with how well British sci-fi shows do with the Emmy juries.
Yeah, the unfortunate thing is that there is so much television and so much that gets submitted for Emmy nominations that people simply do not watch everything that comes across their desk. So it often is based off the preferences of the people who are putting together the ballots. And if they're not already a Doctor Who fan, they may not be very inclined to watch the show that they don't already watch and thus to nominate it for some Emmy Awards. But nominees will be announced July 12th, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Me too. I do wonder, you know, this, I'm not trying to be intentionally pessimistic here, but Twice Upon a Time is the capstone for six series of Stephen Moffat excellence and three series of Peter Capaldi excellence, and it's not exactly self-contained. How do you think it holds up as a TV movie for somebody who'd be coming in cold?
I mean, it doesn't really. Like, it is a superb episode of television. I would never recommend that anybody come in cold to this story because basically you end up with the main character dying throughout the entire thing with no explanation of how he got there, why he's dying. It's also a reference back to the First Doctor's regeneration, a very old episode of television that is probably even more unlikely for US-based Emmy voters to have watched. I mean, there are a lot of barriers to it. And I think that if you're not already inclined to it, there's a lot of things that someone might look at that and go, don't know if I'm going to watch that when I've got all of these other things to watch before I choose which ones I'm going to vote for to get a nomination. So, you know, it's a fantastic episode of television. I love it dearly. I would throw all the awards in the world at it. I don't have a lot of faith that, you know, Emmy voters are going to intentionally go out of their way to watch everything that has been put up for a nomination.
So what you're saying is we need to start a organized campaign to get people to watch it. Is that it? Who do we at, Alyssa?
I'm saying we crash the gates and we burn down the whole system.
I see no problem with this strategy. And that's the news for this week in time travel. When we come back from our look at what's happening with our fellow podcasts on the network, we'll talk to Kara and Derek, and we'll dive deep into the academic side of Doctor Who fandom. This week on the Incomparable Network.
On Not Playing with Lex and Dan, their summer of James Bond continues with On Her Majesty's Secret Service, starring George Lazenby.
Who?
And Incomparable members get a commentary track.
The Purple Rain may be 3 feet high and rising on your way to Paul's Boutique. It's the 80s album draft on The Incomparable.
And there have been a lot of episodes of Erp Chirp. And I mean a lot.
All this and more at TheIncomparable.com. Erica may forgive us for that.
And we're back continuing our fandom perspective series, and we're going to get a little academic today. We're talking about academic fans, which is sort of the joining point where fandom and academia collide. It's something that I've grown to enjoy more and more over the last couple of years as I've grown as a writer. And joining us today for the conversation are two great ACA fans as well. Please welcome Kara Dennison and Derek Compare.
Hi.
Hello.
I want to kick off the conversation by giving a brief history of the term as I understood it when I was beginning my steps to becoming more of an academic fan. So I read this incredible book in college by Henry Jenkins called Textual Poachers, and it introduced me to the concept of an ACA fan. And the way he describes it is a hybrid creature, which is part fan and part academic. And Jenkins said that the goal of his work has been to bridge the gap between these two worlds. I take it as a personal challenge to find a way to break cultural theory out of the academic bookstore ghetto and open up a larger space to talk about the media that matters to us from a consumer's point of view. So that's where I learned the term. That's where I came to understand it as I was writing papers from an academic perspective and a fandom perspective and trying to find a meeting place between them. So I want to hear more about the work that you both do and how your approach to your work includes both an academic and a fan perspective. So Kara, let's start with you.
When I was younger, I actually talked a lot with my uncle who taught a film appreciation course at a local school, and he always sort of encouraged me to look at a movie and then read more into it. And it didn't matter if it was a highbrow movie or Lethal Weapon or whatever. All the things we talked about always applied. Now, when I got into college and when I got into the wider world, I would start talking like this about movies. And the circle I was in at the time would say, oh my God, shut up, you're ruining it. So I stopped for about 10 years. And I got back into it, and I didn't even know that ACA fan, academic fan was a thing. I was always under the impression, because of this old circle of friends, that they were two things to be kept very far apart, even though I really loved to apply these sort of English class mentalities to the geek stuff. And I really wasn't open to doing it again until very recently when I sent in a pitch for the Black Archive, and I was told that it was exactly what they wanted. And I started sort of branching out and combining my own personal interest in philosophy, especially Jungian psychology and philosophy, with the stuff I read. And I branch out into that not only in the Black Archive, but I started sort of pinging it out there bit by bit and seeing if anyone felt any differently from that old circle. And as it turns out, a lot of people do. And so there's this nice reassurance, and it's come to this point where that's kind of what I do with my time. It's not my career, but it's when I'm asked to come write a piece for a blog, it's what I'm brought in for.
Derek, how about you?
Well, it started growing up always interested in movies and TV and in comics and things like that in general. And I got into Doctor Who when I was in high school, way almost 40 years ago now. And in college, I got interested in courses that were doing that in media, basically in media production and in film studies and things like that. And I didn't see them being too much in conflict, basically. Early on in grad school, actually even before grad school, I knew I was going to go into this as a career. I was really interested in doing a lot of this kind of media study sort of stuff and gravitating to it. So actually the work of Henry Jenkins I encountered as an undergrad in the late 80s when he was still a grad student, actually. And that seemed an approach that made a lot of sense to me because I was reading things from people that were obviously writing about film and writing about television at the time, but seemingly taking a lot of pleasure in that and taking a lot of interest in the idea of pleasure. And this was the thing in a lot of cultural studies work at the time. So when I went to grad school in the 90s, I brought this along. I brought this kind of enthusiasm along. Now, at the same time, though, I still think to this day there's a difference. There's still a gap in my ACA fandom in this way where I have this approach to being deeply interested in Doctor Who and deeply interested in the sorts of things I do in media studies. And there's a lot of confluence between that. But at the same time, I've never actually published anything academic on Doctor Who. And this is different than a lot of other people in my field, like Paul Booth and Matt Hills and others who certainly have. And I think for me, I kind of want to don't cross the streams entirely, even though it's right in the same kind of field. There's still this sense of, I want to keep one realm a little bit more kind of personal, if you will, and the other realm a little bit more work-oriented, even though, again, I'm in humanities-centered media studies, and there's a whole lot of crossover between these concepts. This is the field that Jenkins came out of. This is the field that most fan studies is in, and most of the fan scholars that I know are working intimately in this field. Just on a personal level, I just feel like I can contribute somewhat to this discussion, but I do want to kind of maintain a little bit of a distance, I guess, professionally in some ways and go full on enthusiastic when I'm in the fan spaces. So it's just an interesting kind of thing to negotiate. And I think we all take our own different path to that.
I want to follow up quickly on that. Is the moment for you where you want to draw that distinction based off of the way you want to approach your academic work, or is your perspective more don't make the thing you love your job because then it's harder to be that more enthusiastic about it?
I think it's a combination of those things. I mean, basically, the sorts of things that you do as a fan, the sorts of things that I was doing as a fan, at least, and a lot of others do, you're deeply involved in a text, you want to absorb it, you want to learn more about it, you want to rewatch it. Reread it, those sorts of things. That's very, very common in any kind of academic field in the humanities. That's basically what you do. I guess the difference is the sorts of questions, the analytical questions I want to ask as an academic are a bit different than the ones I would ask as a fan. So I'm more interested in, if we take the expression the forest and the trees, I'm kind of more interested in the forest as a media scholar. I'm more interested in things like how the BBC functions as a public service broadcaster in the 21st century, how Doctor Who is a global phenomenon, how it activates different kinds of audiences in different ways, and how it persists over so many decades. Those are the sorts of things that I'm interested in as an academic, whereas as a fan of the show, I do want to dig down into the details. And, you know, I'm enjoying it on Twitch this past week and getting into, you know, comments on the merits of Roger Delgado as the Master or on Alpha Centauri's appearance, for example, in the episodes we're seeing this week. So I haven't brought that part of it into my own fandom. The closest I did come was a few years ago, and this piece was supposed to be published. This is a piece on the classic series DVDs. And this was kind of not a celebration of them. It was a bit of a critique of the DVD range in that they do bring a remastered idea of what Doctor Who is to a contemporary audience, or contemporary, at least in the DVD era. And they do bring this forward. But at the same time, they kind of crystallize a version of the show that is built around the perspectives of mostly men who were middle-aged at that time. Basically, if you grew up in the 70s and 80s, those are the perspectives that the DVDs really kind of solidify. And that, to me, it was a little bit sad that that was going to be the definitive edition of the classic series going forward. And so I critique this idea of why should this be the only version if this is going to live on and future audiences are going to watch these shows, or there should be different kind of approaches to it when you're coming in as different generations, maybe with different gendered perspectives and different racial perspectives and so on. And this is a critique that, again, going back to The Forest and the Trees, this is a critique that I have of a lot of cinephilia, a lot of ways in which audiences that grew up with particular texts, they want to kind of claim them and own them. And I'm interested in the ways in which that's challenged as the generations go on and the texts are still there for people to enjoy, and how are the original audiences open to new audiences interpreting them and understanding them. So that was the one Doctor Who example where I did almost have a publication on that, but the book it was supposed to be in fell through. So, you know, that's how that goes.
I have a quick question for the both of you. Kara, you talked about how initially when you dug deep into the stuff that you were watching, that your friends and fellow fans around you would act as though you were ruining it by looking too closely at it. Do you feel like there's still any sort of a tension between the academic perspective on, say, Doctor Who and the fandom experience of that? And then, Derek, how well does academia treat ACA fandom and popular culture studies?
For me, the more I dig into academics and the more I talk about it, the more I tend to find the people who like it. But I am aware that there are people who, if you say anything, and this is where I think there is an issue in my mind, if you say anything beyond a baseline opinion, they think you're criticizing. Where if I start to take something apart and I start to say, this means this, and this does this, and this does that, it gets so deep that people start to assume that you're leading up to negativity, or you're tearing it apart for something other than enjoyment. I'm seeing less of that than I used to, and I don't know if that's the company I keep. I don't know if that's a change going forward, because as I said, up until college, I lived in this sort of, you know, very small space that was mostly my family, and I had to learn about the world around me and their opinions. But I think there is still a little bit of a conflict. I know also that once in a while when I talk about this stuff, like, and for me, this is my fun. Like Derek was talking about keeping the two things separate. I'm weird in that that is my joy. I walk away from a movie and I'm just like, oh my God, did you see how, you know, this led to this? And, you know, that's what I come in for. And sometimes when I talk with my friends, they go, I have no idea what you're talking about, but I'm glad you're happy, which kind of feels bad because I don't want to alienate people. But at the same time, I understand that sometimes people don't want to cut that deep. Sometimes people just want to watch the show they like. And I think people who go particularly deep, once in a while, that's seen as almost threatening when theoretically, I guess it could be, because there are 7 billion people in the world, so it's not like there's not one person out there who does something a certain way. That's a really bold claim to make. I'm sure there's someone out there who does it like that. But for me and for the people I tend to know and the people I like to read, the goal is not usually to destroy, but it's often taken that way simply because it's more words than I like, I don't like.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I can kind of share that perspective at least too in some of my circles and in the fan circles in particular on that side of it. I think on the academic side with the question about popular culture, we have to keep in mind that a lot of these fields are really, really young in general terms here. I mean, it's only been fairly recently that something as modern as, quote, you know, as film was allowed in the classroom. That was only a few decades ago that film was even allowed, right? So we're coming from an academic history where academic has meant the classics, right? Over 100 years ago, if something was published in English, it was dubious, right, to be included in the class in an academic context. And so I think there's a lot of that weight and baggage that still kind of weighs down on academia. That said, when I came in the 80s was this period where film studies had been around for about 20 years, where television studies was just kind of getting going, and where the study of the popular, of popular culture as a legitimate academic field was starting to really take off and coalesce at that time. Now, the way into that for most people in the field, I think it is a lot of their fandom for whatever it is that they're into. But the way to sustain that as an academic is precisely what Kara was saying, with that level of critique, that level of kind of you're enjoying it, but you're skeptical of that enjoyment too. And for, you know, there's a political edge to that. There's a kind of political critique that's built in with this of capitalism, let's say, or of mainstream ideology, you know, whatever, but may motivate you. But that seems to be your way in to both bring in the sort of thing that you're interested in looking at, you know, whether that's Doctor Who or for some people, horror films or popular music or romantic comedies or whatever it is they're interested in, but also having this kind of other angle where you're taking in the broader context, you're analyzing it in the broader context and trying to put it in that kind of in that kind of position. That's the move that on the academic side legitimates that. It seems to legitimate that study. It's like, oh, okay, if you're studying this sort of thing, it only makes sense then if you're studying it in this kind of context where you're linking it into this broader kind of political and cultural kind of question rather than just you like it or you don't like it. Whereas, as Kara was saying on the fan side and with just general people, to take it beyond that kind of question is sometimes difficult to do. It's sort of difficult to get those conversations going in some of those contexts. Increasingly, though, I agree. I mean, I think it's getting better with this. And I think a lot of the conversations, both online and at conventions, have really been interesting to kind of take down that path in some ways. But I think that difference still maintains to a certain degree. And again, it just has to do with where academia, what the traditions, if you will, of academia and the traditions of fans are.
Yeah, and it's for me, I've noticed that with fans, it's getting lesser. Like, more people are interested in what I have to say about Doctor Who when I have something to say that's a little more than, you know, I liked it or whatever. It's academia. The few people I know in certain areas of academia that seem to sort of turn an eye. Like, you know, when I say I wrote a scholarly monograph on Doctor Who, it's like I've just said I put chicken nuggets on the fine china. You know, it's like you're using your nice tools on the junk food, which I think a major part of where the divide is what do you consider worth it? Like, and that's a lot of what I'm coming out of now. Once I've come into an area where fans are happy to hear this, it's now the academics who are going, you know, these are kind of the things you use on Wuthering Heights. This is what you use on Chinatown. This is what you use on the greats, the classics, not on the thing that showed up on TV last week.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to really dig into that divide and how we make academic fandom more accessible to more people, because one of the things that I've noticed more recently about academic fandom is that there is a little bit of a breaking out of the ivory tower. There's a lot of people who are engaging in academic fandom that I don't want to diminish them. They have very impressive professional credentials and they have done a lot of very serious work in the topic that they're in, but they're not necessarily professors at a university. They're not on an academia track, and they are writing about Doctor Who and other fandoms in more casual environments. So they have a blog post on a website, which is fully sourced and has footnotes, but it's a blog post and it's not published in an academic journal or in a book. You have a little bit of a breaking down of the barriers here, which would drive my college professor absolutely crazy, because the first run through that she did of my symposium work at the end of my undergrad career was to go, this is not from an academic journal. You cannot include this in the paper that you are currently writing as a source or another commentary on the work that you're doing. So what are sort of the tensions here? Is there, you know, an upside to the fact that academic fandom is breaking out of academia? And are there reasons that perhaps some of it should remain on a academia track?
I mean, when you talk about people who write blog posts and are not an academic track, that is 100% me. I was never on an academic track. I enjoy that kind of stuff, but I'm a journalist. I write for Crunchyroll. That's my day job, and then I write sci-fi at night. Even though I write this kind of stuff, I've never been a professor. I've never wanted to be a professor. It's a hobby. Again, it's like I was talking about with you can't use these tools on this stuff. I think the more people who are not academics come into this area and play in this area, because there's not just one form of it. There are so many ways to analyze a thing. Like, what you guys talk about on your podcast is not necessarily what I do, is not necessarily what Derek does. And there are as many insights as there are people. And the more people just go and take these things and write from their point of view, the more welcoming it becomes. And like you were saying, breaking out of the ivory tower, I do think a lot of people are afraid who aren't academics. Like, they want to say a thing and they want to talk about a thing and they have an experience that is not purely academic. It could be a life experience. It could be a hobby. It could be something they learned growing up. And they have a thing to say and they have the tools and they know how to do works cited, but they don't feel qualified to speak in such a way. And as we move more towards the ACAFAN, I love that term. It's my first time hearing it today, and I'm going to use it forever. I'm keeping it. The more we move towards that middle ground of fans can talk academically, academics can talk about fan stuff and sort of meet in the middle and take away that fear for people who have a thing they want to say. And I think we can only grow from that. And I do see it, and I am seeing more of it, and I am seeing so many people actually going that direction. Again, I was shocked when I saw that what I do is not weird, when I saw that there is a whole community of it, and multiple communities of it, and that deserves to grow, and that deserves to be something that anyone is encouraged to access and to try, just to see, you know, if they like it or if they have something to say, and just see how they do.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's one thing in recent years I've seen more and more of, and I really, really appreciate that too, just to see more people give that a shot and put that out there. I think, and I agree with Gary, I think it's more coming from the fan side of people like digging in and publishing some great stuff. And there's a longer history of this, but I think it's really been a bit more prominent in recent years and on blogs in particular. On the academic side, it's tricky because, again, historically, if you think of academics as a career, and I am a career academic, basically. I got my PhD 19 years ago, and I've been a professor ever since. So this is, you know, I'm steeped in this as a career. And if you're a career academic, there is still to this day this institutional kind of suspicion of writing for the public, right? Writing for a broad audience. And you quote unquote should be writing for an academic audience. And I disagree with that wholeheartedly. And I think increasingly a lot of academics do. And so there's more sort of wanting to write for a broader audience, more sort of wanting to write for an audience that isn't necessarily going to be steeped in all of the language and jargon, but you can make ways of helping people understand that. And publishing in venues that aren't just academic presses and journals that are inaccessible to most people. So I think there's a long way that still needs to come. I think that for career reasons, people are being sort of dissuaded from doing that. I mean, you can certainly, I think the attitude these days is more, you can certainly do that, but it's not going to count towards your career as much as publishing in a prominent academic press or a prominent journal, right? So for example, the Black Archive is an excellent example of this. I would love to do a Black Archive book. However, I don't feel comfortable enough doing that. Even though I'm an associate professor, at some point in my career, I want to go up again. And if I were to publish a book like this, I would get a lot of sort of pushback of saying, well, why don't you publish an academic book for your career, right? So there's a lot of pressures on that. And all throughout your career, I mean, I'm an old academic, but a lot of younger academics have this too. And so what I'm trying to do as an academic in there is help encourage people to reach out and cross over these audiences, cross over these sorts of things. Because what we do should be accessible to the public. It should be. We should have these conversations together. We shouldn't just be up in ivory towers there and have these conversations. So I hope we get to have more of these across you know, venues like this or at conventions and everything and those sorts of things where people can get together and talk about that. I mean, one thing with ACCA fans, it's interesting. A lot of ACCA fans seem to be more involved with other ACCA fans more than with the fandoms that they're involved with sometimes. And I sometimes wonder about that. If we're ACCA fans in some ways, but we're still kind of careerists in other sorts of ways, and ways that other fans, you know, don't have to have those sorts of don't have to have that worry or that pressure about.
One of the most accessible ways that people can begin to learn about academic fandom is at local conventions. More and more, I'm seeing conventions host an academic track where people can come in and talk about the topics that they've been writing about. So from your perspectives, what distinguishes an academic track or an academic panel from what you typically see at a convention?
Yeah, I guess I'll take this on because I've been going to fan conventions for a long time, but I know I've been to more academic conferences than fan conventions. The biggest difference to me is that an academic presentation tends to have four, maybe five people on it. Each person will present something for 15 to 20 minutes. They'll present their paper. Oftentimes they'll read it verbatim, which is just terrible, but they'll oftentimes do that. And then there'll be time after all the papers are presented for a good sort of discussion for about 20 or 30 minutes about what was in the papers and everything. Whereas at a fan panel, they tend to have twice as many people oftentimes. I've been at fan panels which have, you know, upwards of eight or nine people. And it's kind of a mad dash of getting everybody in to say something interesting. It's a much more off the cuff. It's here's what we're talking about today. And it kind of veers widely from the topic. You jump in with the audience questions earlier. It's a lot more kind of interactive. And so those modes are really, they're very different. I mean, they're very different. One of them is honed, and here's this thing that I've worked on for a long time. Here's what I'm going to present to you. And the other is, hey, it's of the moment. We're talking about this topic for now. What do you guys think? And a lot of back and forth and discussion about that. So there's academic venues that are trying to experiment a bit more with that. I go to one in Austin every couple of years where everybody gets basically 2 minutes to give their spiel on the assumption that they've published their bit a much shorter bit earlier, and then we launch right into the discussion. So that's a lot more kind of interactive. And to me, that's always reminded me a bit more of fan conventions. And as you said, in fan conventions, we're seeing more of an academic track. So like at Galley last year, where we did have those presentations that were a bit more similar to the traditional academic kind of presentation. So they're different beasts, and that mode of their difference is interesting, but I'm always interested in ways we can kind of close the gap between them a bit more.
Kara, you're not getting away with that anymore, because at future conventions, you and I are going to come together and go, we wrote these two Black Archive books, and now we're going to talk about them.
This is fair. This is fair. I think on the few academic style panels, because I don't want to say I've done an actual academic panel, because I've not been on anything like Derek discussed. I have been on solo or two-person panels that are definitely teaching. My main thing about those style of panels is I'm always shocked when more than three people show up, because I feel like when you present, when you say, this is going to be a teaching panel, this is going to be an academic panel, and you don't have a PhD after your name, and sometimes even if you do, you're going to get kind of a short list. But shockingly to me, those are very well attended panels now, which is very heartening. And the best part, honestly, is when you turn it around and you hear all the insights from the other people. And that is my shock. I did a very small college convention a few months ago, local, and they had me do a panel on the genres of Doctor Who and how it is everything but a sci-fi most of the time. And I talked about how each era of the show, by showrunner, by decade, by what have you, can almost be divided up into a genre of its own, and talking about, you know, the soap opera, the fairy tale, the science fantasy. And that room was packed to the back. And I was shocked, because I thought, oh no, they're going to want, like, you know, a discussion about one particular doctor. But there were people there who absolutely wanted to hear that, who wanted to have the discussion, who wanted to ask questions. And I feel like years ago, I either wouldn't have seen that or I wouldn't have expected to see it. And I love the enthusiasm that people have for that.
I think there's a growing kind of hunger for that and a participation in that. And I think people are more, I think people in general are more exposed to the sorts of ideas and kind of concepts in there. And as particularly if you're an avid fan, you've been reading a lot and taking in a lot of other commentary and things. And so you may be thinking a lot of those things yourselves. And so I think I've noticed that too. It's really nice to see. And there's events like what Paul Booth does at DePaul every year, which is basically have this kind of ACAFAN environment. And he picks a theme every year and brings in fans and academics to discuss them and throws them on the same panels together and everything. And it's really fascinating. I was on the Doctor Who one he did 5 years ago, and I gave a couple of talks on there. And again, these are just short little talks, glosses basically on ideas I had. One was about sound in Doctor Who, and one was about the DNA of Doctor Who, basically, of this kind of larger picture thing. But it worked in well together with the fans and the other academics on the panels, and we had a lot of good discussion in the room. There's loads of people there, so it's I've had really when I've been able to do these sorts of experiences at conventions, I've had really good experiences and great feedback from them.
So if you happen to be going to a convention and you see an academic track, definitely check it out, because there is fantastic stuff getting talked about there. Derek, Kara, thank you so much for joining us to talk about academic fandom.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for joining us on This Week in Time Travel. You can find us online at thisweekintimetravel.com. We're on Twitter at @DRWhoThisWeek. Chip is on Twitter at @2MinuteTimeLord. I'm on Twitter and Tumblr at @WhovianFeminism. Kara is on Twitter at @RubyCosmos. And Derek is on Twitter at @DCompare, which is DKOMPARE. We're also on Facebook, too, and Kara and I have Black Archive books coming out next month and then in August, so I'll post stuff about that on the Twitters.
This moment of self-promotion brought to you by This Week in Time Travel. Our music was brought to us by Christopher Breen. David J. Lohr gave us our artwork. Please review us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you find podcasts. Please consider becoming a member of the Incomparable Network and tell all your friends about us. Until next week, this is Chip.
This is Alyssa.
And you've been listening to This Week in Time Travel.
Bye-bye.